Welcome to another episode of the Reboot Chronicles, a no-holds-barred forum with global leaders, authors, entrepreneurs, and CEOs about how organizations stay focused on growth and innovation in unprecedented times. I'm your host, Dean DeBias, coming to you live from Reviv's North American headquarters in Chicago, and we would like to thank you for joining us from around the globe today. On the Reboot Chronicles, we talk with a lot of CEOs about their challenges of running some of the world's biggest and fastest-growing companies. Some of them were rebooted by re-energizing what I call the three P's, or people, platform, and passion. As many of you know, we've got into that many times, but sometimes it's just not enough, and companies run into trouble, big trouble, and they need help. What they need is a turnaround. And with stats anywhere from 90% of startups failing and the average S&P-listed company tenure has been in decline for decades, reboots and turnarounds are going to continue to rise in the roaring 20s here. The problem is they get big, they get fat, they get slow, which isn't the end of the world, but that leads to the worst thing. It leads to the death spiral of irrelevance, obscurity, and decline. There are literally hundreds and hundreds of examples across industries, especially from retail, of course. Everything from Toys R Us and Sears to Brookstone and Blockbuster. But what we don't hear about much is the turnarounds that are actually working, actively being rebooted as we speak. And these are the next generation companies that hopefully will survive, and many of them are going to thrive. So that's why I invited restructuring guru Scott Stewart, who's the CEO of Turnaround Management Association, to the program. TMA is a global nonprofit that strengthens the economy by helping distressed companies improve performance, manage disruption, and restructure the future of work. They've got about 10,000 members now with 58 chapters worldwide. And a lot of the members are people like me and my colleagues, as they are actively stepping in and saving companies around the world. Scott, it's good to see you.
Good to see you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's looks like a good view in Chicago there. Those of you that aren't on the video channel, he's looking pretty happy there. Yeah, a lot of people don't know about turnarounds. It's not something you hear in the news too much, except when there's bad news. How does TMA, you know, help companies around the world turn around? What's the secret sauce?
Yeah, thanks for positioning that question that way, because I think you've kind of hit it exactly on the head. We don't just turn around companies. We also spearhead problems early in time. So, for example, when we say we are the premier organization in the corporate restructuring, corporate reorganization, and corporate health space, we have professionals who are trained to spearhead problems before they become problems. So hopefully we can ward them off. You know, some people like to look at turnaround professionals as the undertakers. We're not the undertakers. we're the fix-it people who want to make things better. Although people look at us as, oh, if we're bringing the turnaround people in, then obviously it's over.
Everyone runs for the door. And yeah, I mean, back that's probably fair. Back in the old days, they were kind of grave dancers or chainsaw guys.
Well, certainly in the dot-com days, that was the case, because when the dot-coms went bust, you know, back in the late 90s, there was nothing to save.
Yeah.
They went bust, they went away. What did you have? You had a dot-com name that had zero value. So
that's a good spin on it. What do you look for if you were like to take on a new turnaround? What, in terms of, there's a leading question here, but what I want to get into is some successes and failures and what's working and what's not. But maybe back up and it's like, hey, when I look at one from 10,000 feet, here's what I look at. And this is what I like to see, because it is still savable. What's important there?
Yeah, we'll choose an industry. I mean, you go back years and the airline industry, learned that it had to consolidate, right?
Yeah.
It was after deregulation, it got too big too fast. The competitive landscape ate into profits in a very grave way, and the airlines all went through bankruptcies and ultimately consolidated back to a smaller group of airlines, most of which have found their financial modeling to be very successful. Right now, coming out of the last several years, retail is suffering greatly in commercial real estate, particularly with technology moving us to more online purchasing and not the necessity for big rents and big box stores all across America. So, you know, technology is changing the world for sure. And the last several years have taught us that we've had these great technological tools at our disposal. And now that we're using those technological tools to our advantage, at the same time, it has a negative impact on certain aspects of our economy as we're figuring out what the future of our economy looks like.
Yeah, and there's many companies that could benefit by, they're just under-digitized, as we call it, especially some of the old school ones, different industries. I mean, the airlines were interesting. They were just, it was just, a lot of people called them a nonprofit industry for a while. And now it's, you know, now it's just the opposite. But beyond consolidation, what do you look for in terms of growth and innovation opportunities to grow their way out of a problem versus efficiency and insight and cutting cost and that type of thing? How do you balance that left right brain stuff?
Great question. And whether you're talking about a startup or the airline industry, you're talking about finding a financial model that makes sense. The airline industry used to sell seats. Well, they don't just sell seats anymore. They sell grades of seats. They sell upgrades. They sell legroom. They sell how many bags you can bring on a plane without an extra cost. So they came up with a cost model that, although criticized, turned them from what you say was a not-for-profit industry into one that's learned how to be profitable by creating gradations in opportunity.
You know, that's like monetization of your base and changing the business model. I mean, a lot of industries have a hard time doing that. I mean, with airlines, it worked great. I mean, next thing you know, they're going to be charging for oxygen or something. But can every industry do that? Can they monetize their way out of a situation?
No, you know, certainly not. Look, as industry changes, technology changes, as we look at our economy through a different lens,
yep,
there are going to be survivors and there are going to be those that fail. And nothing is forever. I mean, look at the startup world. You hit the statistic right on the head from the beginning when you made the introduction to this podcast. 90% of startups fail, right? Because they may be great ideas, but a great idea doesn't turn into an idea that you can necessarily successfully monetize and grow. And if you don't have the capitalization to critically look at it or use a turnaround professional such as, you know, the ones in my organization to assist you to be able to operationally identify what that is, then those businesses are not going to survive. And it doesn't mean that's not necessarily a bad thing. Economies, industry all need to be cleansed as they form, define, refine, and develop.
It's interesting your startup comment, because the 90% number, it is on the high side. It depends on where you are, what industry, what category, I guess. But the you know, many of them, when you look at the data, I just did a keynote on this a few weeks ago. The number one reason they are failing now, not just startups, but small businesses in general, are lack of a product market fit. So wrong product, wrong time, where they just never did any ethnography or talk to anyone. And then all the other reasons pop up, you know, bad founders, no funding, all that stuff. But these ongoing companies, these big behemoths, is product market fit more of an issue? You know, like, you know, some people had the wrong lineup of products, like, you know, I mentioned in the intro, or is it more the team has just run out of gas and, you know, the people that got us here are not the people that are going to take us to the next level, which is usually more of a startup issue. What are the telltale signs on, you know, multinational, multi-billion dollar companies? What usually happens?
So,
the death spiral I was talking about.
Well, look, a great example, Kodak, who years ago filed for bankruptcy, had every ounce of technology and technological wherewithal, developmental intelligence and opportunity on its side, but got so comfortable in the business model that made it a success for a long, long period of time that it went into a spiral because it wasn't seeing that around it. The startup world, the technology world, the next generation of opportunists in a good way,
right,
took advantage of technology and moved beyond what they were. So you can't get sedentary in any multinational business. You can't get sedentary in a model that you are without constantly being introspective about what works, what doesn't, what you need, what you may need to change, and whether that may be as simple as management who comes in with a new vision, a new lens, and a different kind of experience, to looking at your business model and seeing what the competition or what the competition of the next generation that hasn't even evolved is starting to look at and you're not.
Exactly. And that's why I didn't answer the question for you, because my view is big, fat, slow companies, it's a leadership problem. Then there's others problems. But yeah, with the startups, it was more product market fit, which isn't always the big company problems. It's the leadership recognizing there's a, you know, coming up, there's a big gap in their business model. So what's working now? You know, what's working, what's not working in terms of turnarounds?
So interesting. We're in a very, very interesting time. We're coming out of over a decade of almost 0% interest rates and a lot of free money spread across the world.
Those are fun times.
Yes, they were. But the problem is that what we're doing is we're normalizing. And normalization also is creating huge discomfort. Because while we're normalizing, and then you have ancillary factors, AI, climate change, things that are putting pressure on the economy to many looks a lot worse than it necessarily is. Yeah, does it cost more money to buy groceries this year than it did last because of inflation? Absolutely. But does that mean the economy is in a weaker spot than it was last year? Absolutely not. So we are looking at what some look at as counterintuitive forces through a very narrow lens, because we're coming out of a period where people lived high on the hog and it didn't cost them very much to actually do that. And industry benefited the most because industry was getting very inexpensive money at very low interest rates without much accountability, creating the opportunity to grow businesses that maybe should not have grown or should have consolidated or should have gone away much sooner than they did. So now that we're entering this period of what I like to call normalcy, and I don't look at anything that's going on.
What does that mean, normalizing? What have we done wrong?
We lost a decade of normal counter-cyclicality. Economies need to pause and cleanse. And when people say, oh, it's been great that we haven't had a recession in a decade. No, that's not great. Well, with the exception of during the pandemic, we had a short recessionary period. But if you look at the number of zombie companies that were kind of made out of air, in a recessionary period, those companies would get cleansed out of the economy because they couldn't survive. Well, now money has a real cost to it, and loans that are being made and the cost of capital, whether it be venture capital or traditional lending, has a cost and has accountability to it that didn't exist for almost a decade. And then the people who are actually in companies and navigating these problems and trying to figure out what a turnaround looks like have very little experience actually doing it.
Exactly.
So if you take people who started as junior managers who are now senior folks in the companies that they're either running them or they're the turnaround professionals that are being brought in to fix them, a lot of them just don't have the experience or wherewithal or know-how as to how to deal with them, because so much time has passed where we've not experienced this period that I think is a lot more normal than the period we're just coming out of, for sure.
Yes, that's usually when they call people like us, because you know, you've got the muscle memory, seeing around corners, as John Chambers and I were talking a few weeks ago, and just the whole ability to, you know, reshape it and reboot something into, unfortunately, a different vision than they had. So it's, you mentioned a couple of things there. You made fun of unicorns. So they have so much money that they could in the bank, which is excellent. You know, if you raise $1 billion, it's your valuation's going to maybe be higher. but they can still reboot themselves into something different if they admit it. Whereas the little struggling ones, it's really, really tough to do. So we went through a SPAC era too, where everything was, you know, it was a SPAC attack. And I can't tell you how many groups I had to talk to about. They had all this money. So SPAC, for those of you who know, you're basically going public, raising a shell company, and then you go out and buy stuff. It didn't go very well. But the real question I had there is more around M&A. So when you're looking at a reboot turnaround and you're saying, you know, what I usually coach people on, CEOs, is listen, you've got to figure out what you're going to build, what you're going to borrow, partner with, and what you actually do want to buy, acquire. And they usually jump right to the acquire stack. And I tell them, listen, there's many things you can do without buying these companies to accelerate your growth by partnering and borrowing. Heaven forbid you start building something different. It's hard to shift, especially if they have factories, into building. But I find that it's the M&A and the partnering is a quicker way to get the revenue acceleration going, because they don't have to wait. You know, take Ford as an example. You've got to wait a few years to build that massive factory in Tennessee. And so how do you feel about the build, buy, borrow, you know, kind of matrix and using that as a strategic tool for turning around companies?
I think you hit it right. I think that those who strategically partner where they can be supported as they're building, It's not just building and buying. It's merging strategically correctly so that you then have the ability to take a higher level of risk than if you just jump from A to C without doing the middle step. And you know, particularly in the startup world, those that are even early stage that roll up and then are better capitalized are the ones that tend to survive, even if they hit bumps in the road and have to change their model along the way. That's no different than private industry at the multinational level either. I mean, you look at the automotive industry, for example, where there's this huge movement to zero carbon emissions, battery operated cars.
Yeah.
And
I've written about some, I've written about that in Forbes, and I think my opening line was, I don't remember them outlawing horses while the combustion engine was being developed. So I think it's being over incentivized, but let us not get political on this show.
you don't have to get political, but what I can say about that is, because of the pressure politics has put on zero carbon emissions, it's putting pressure and theoretically premature pressure on industries that are not financially suited today.
They're not ready.
They're not mega radical conversion to zero carbon emissions when you've been fossil fuel based for 100 years. And I'm using that 100 years as kind of an out there kind of thing. But you get the feel of it. You just don't flip a switch and say, we're now going to become zero carbon emissions. Or you don't take a traditional auto factory and say, well, you're going to have to be 80% battery compliant by 2050. You got to be realistic about this. And if you think that these are not going to create economic fallout, it's why people, you know, here in the Turnaround Management Association are called in to situations where there's these external pressures that are being put on companies that aren't sure how to necessarily retool and deal what's being imposed on them. And that doesn't mean that the businesses are not healthy or that the businesses are not good, sustainable businesses, but external pressures are being placed on them that are causing them to have to make changes in their models fundamentally that are going to cause some not to be able to survive. And that's, you know, kind of...
That's fascinating. It's like public policy, right or wrong, can force industries, or let's just say companies, especially the two second-tier automobile industry example, into turnaround. You can almost have a turnaround prediction index here. You know who's going to need help before they know. So yeah, I bet you're getting a lot of calls on that. You also mentioned other things that are transforming industries. So we've talked a lot about AI. I write about it in Forbes, and just about every CEO now that we've had on is all over it. I can't think of one that like isn't ignoring it, but they're seriously just trying to catch up with it and understand it and cut through the hype. The signal and noise is a little iffy. But how are you seeing some of these old traditional turnarounds being shaken up by AI?
That's the best question of all, because AI is a double-edged sword. Change is not natural for people. AI has come at us like a tsunami of change. It is the precipice of the fourth industrial revolution in history, and every industrial revolution causes initial suffrage economically, as this one will.
Yes, sir.
There will be job disruption. There will be industry disruption. There will be retooling and rethinking of business models. AI is going to be a tremendous leap forward for society and the world. But in the short term, it's also going to cause a lot of pain. And we will gravitate to technology, and it will be a wonder. But people are going to have to learn over the course of time how to adapt to what that means, whether it means more automated trucks or whether it means less people working on the factory line. I mean, those are just the most elementary examples that I could put out there. But people don't like disruption. People react to it adversely because it's change. And this change, and I hesitate to use the word radical, this change is happening pretty radically and pretty fast. And
I think radical is a light word for this one.
Yeah. When you're talking about an industrial revolution, yes.
Yep.
I mean, this is the develop. You know, back in the 1700s when we were developing the hoe to help farmers, you know, that was an industrial revolution. This is an industrial revolution that is going to change the face of what industry looks like.
Yeah, and there's some people, we won't name names, but there's some multinationals with their heads in the sand, or they're just paying consultants too much to get through this. But if you look back at other inventions, you know, the printing press, it's like they kind of use it to make Bibles for a while, and then newspapers. It was like the impact to society was not well understood. Same thing for shopping on the internet and other things. And eventually we figure things out. Like AI, I think people are learning from history lessons and saying, no, this is going to, and I'm not just talking about the consultants' brochures, but they're saying this is going to reshape your industry. And is your membership or more traditional turnaround folks, are they even ready for it?
Yeah, that's a great question. And the answer is yes. The consulting community particularly is very in tune with understanding, learning, and gravitating to what the effects of AI in particular are already starting to mean in traditional industries, manufacturing yep. being, you know, right there, right on top of the list. And we're trying to make sure that our professionals are getting into situations early to do assessments, just do assessments to understand what might be coming, even if it doesn't necessarily hit you today. But the fact that we are trying to train our professionals are internally in their consulting firms being trained to identify and spearhead these as, again, this goes back to corporate health. You can have a very healthy business model that's going to have to be reactive and change to what AI is going to impose on it. But you got to look at the signs. You got to identify when you're ready, and you have to be prepared to be prepared to adapt. And it's, yes, that's a lot simpler than it sounds. And of course, there are going to be people who are slower to gravitating to technological change. And they're going to be people that are going to put up blinders and say, my model is just too good to necessarily have to change with the immediacy that's being imposed on me. Unfortunately, the wave will happen, and people will either be prepared or they won't. And those that aren't prepared will either be absorbed by others, and it'll be the beneficiaries will be those that will take on the good business models and adapt it to an AI environment, or we'll lose some companies that had good models along.
We will, and they'll be big ones. That's why I mentioned the average tenure on the S&P has gone down from, you know, 35 to 40 years down to, some people argue, under 10. It's really around 15. But let's shift a little bit in terms of regions. You know, I spent a lot more time with Asia, you know, companies in China and South America, and specifically India. What's going on over there?
India is probably the most fascinating study of where the world is moving towards. While all the focus has been on China, the excitement is really in India, because India will surpass China as the world's largest economy by 2034. And there's a lot of ingenuity, a lot of entrepreneurship, and at the same time, a lot of business failure there. I can tell you from a corporate turnaround and restructuring point of view, Indian legal and turnaround processes are right now at a very immature phase. They're going to start to catch up. And in fact, it's one of our fastest growing chapters at the Turnaround Management Association because of the volume of startups, entrepreneurial opportunities, and
that's off the charts, sure.
Off the charts business growth.
I mean, that country, the reason I like it over China, it has a good rule of law. It is entrepreneurial. It is, you know, enterprise focus. But you're saying, yeah, but they don't necessarily have the, you know, all the legal and restructuring, all the back office stuff that you have to do to properly restructure, versus growth guys that we just care about, can you make something out of this asset or not? So back office wise, they've got some growing to do, it sounds like. And what about their economy? You mentioned economies need to ebb and flow. I mean, they've kind of just been growing.
Yes, I think they're going to continue in a pretty strong growth trajectory.
Okay.
The bumps you're going to see is normal consolidation along the way. You can see growth.
Yep.
Number of people coming into the marketplace, being very competitive with each other, failure, consolidation. That doesn't necessarily mean the economy is going to fail, and in fact, it probably won't. It'll continue to grow. It'll be the bumps that'll create the consolidation that'll start to refine and define what that economy looks like and what its strengths are. But I don't think anywhere you look in the world, and you certainly are an expert in this, anywhere you look in the world, all eyes are on India, as you said, even more so than China.
And one of the lessons learned that, you know, people, leaders should learn, is their prime minister is just extremely pro-business, and it's, you're having trouble, come here. Speaking of governments, I love poking fun at governments. Those, if you've watched some episodes, don't we need a turnaround management association for governments, both federal agencies as well as, let's just call it, cities? Cities all over the world have been struggling forever. But, you know, as we're in the roaring 20s, a lot of the warts are starting to show because, you know, debts are coming due and all types of things. And we don't always put the best leaders in power. But is that a startup we should look at? Maybe turn around for cities?
You know, I love it. I love the idea. However,
I'll call you later. We'll work on this one. Probably shouldn't have told everybody.
Yeah, you let the secret out of the bag, but you're going to have to take the retired politicians who made it work, become the people who had that.
Oh, they're all going to want to be on the board. It'll be awful.
Yeah, you know, you raise a really good point there. You know, you look at a situation like the turnaround of Detroit, Michigan. We made Dugan there.
Good example. Yeah.
It was a great storied advocate who has led the transition out of their Chapter 9 bankruptcy into a great story of success. The New York Times recently did a nice, really nice piece on the 10-year story that has led Detroit back to a very respectable city. But you know what? The winds of change politically, if you don't have the kind of leader that can lead a city out of financial distress or trouble, and look, you can look all around America right now where cities are struggling to redefine what they are coming out of the last turbulent few years, whether it's just the homelessness situation in San Francisco because you don't have as many
there's a whole list. Yeah, pensions, bureaucracy, corruption, you name it, just keep going.
Yeah,
there's no shortage of that. But yeah, it seems like there's an opportunity. If you look at sport teams, you look at companies, recruit CEOs, you look for that, whatever. The searches are global. You find the best people and you put them in the seat. And it just seems like everything. You have decades of knowledge in this organization with tens of thousands of people who've been in and out of. It seems like their skill set should be unleashed on some of the government stuff. I know a lot of the voters would like it. Anyway, we digress. But what when you look out of the next 5 years, just from what are you excited about in terms of what TMA's doing and helping companies with?
Yeah, that's a great question, and thank you. You know, our professionals being the conglomeration of the most diverse professional group of people in the world, where we gain our knowledge is because we have lawyers, consultants, financiers, private equity folks. So as an actionable organization, we're able to draw on the skills of each other and the relationships we have with each other and the learnings of each other to attack situations very holistically. We're not looking through a one lens in terms of how to look at situations. So whether it be the rebirth of cities or the transformation because of climate change to converting companies zero carbon emissions to raising money that are going to help ease the pain of adapting to a model that is going to change employment because of AI, we have the professionals that can look at it from all angles and create the right solution for companies in almost any sector you look at. Commercial estate.
So it sounds like it's not your father's TMA. This is, you've got,
no.
You're bringing in the next gen people that really can. Yeah. Yeah. We really want to thank you for joining us today, by the way. You have any personal reboot stories you went through? Or is this what you always planned on doing and everything worked out perfectly?
No, are you kidding? I wanted to be a weatherman, for Pete's sake.
A weatherman? Come on. I never would have guessed that.
There I was, you know, the kid like who loved radio, set up my little tape recorder.
You're in front of a weather map, actually. So this is good.
Yeah, you know, this actually happened by accident. I think the only two courses I didn't take in law school were bankruptcy and tax. Fearful of both of them. And here I am 30 plus years later, having spent 90% of my career as a corporate restructuring professional. And it has been a labor of love every minute of it every day because it's such an actionable field where people are helping real living, breathing things. I mean, we're rehabilitating things for the better for society and our economy. And that's a pretty cool place to be. And my when you say personal reboot, you know, I often lecture to younger people who, when I say to them, raise your hand if you think you know the exact path you're going to take in your career and life. And about 80% of them will raise their hand. And then I go, let me tell you a story.
let me tell you about Scott and Dean. We still don't know.
Exactly. Reinvention is the best invention man ever made.
Yeah. And lastly, I'll just add to that, because we were talking in the warm-ups, like people who are like in corporate jobs now or startups, you know, considering doing what you do, kind of any good ways for them to prep for this? Be their own turnaround guy?
You know, the answer to that one is probably no.
I tell people this is not for the faint of heart either.
No, you know, thank you for saying that. No, it's not for the faint of heart. And let's be real. Change is not natural for most people. And most people, once they get settled into a rhythm and want to be comfortable in that rhythm, want to stay in that kind of rhythm. And, you know, getting thrown off guard, it's a matter of taking a breath, putting a lens on what's being presented to you, taking the strengths that you bring to a situation, a career move, an opportunity, and taking what your strengths are and see how you can impose and overlay those strengths into the opportunity that you're looking at as kind of seizing you in the moment.
Yep.
And believe it or not, in most cases, it works out.
Yeah, great advice. Thanks, Scott. You've been listening to Scott Stewart, who's the CEO of the Turnaround Management Association. This is Dean Tobias with the Reboot Chronicles. We want to thank you for joining us today. We will see you soon.